since it's an overview, I don't believe, I may be getting myself in trouble, but I don't believe we have to have a quorum for an overview.
No, you don't.
So, with that, I will call the roll. Representative Green.
Here.
All right. And Representative Chenault. With that, I'd like to go ahead and introduce, I think, online, do we have Mike Mitchell? Mike, are you there? Hello? Well, if he calls in, then we'll get him on the line a little bit later.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, Mike?
Yes.
Mike, you're with the Department of Law, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and get started, but with that, I guess I'd like to go ahead and introduce a couple other people. Also, Wayne Rush is, Wayne, I don't know what your title would be. Little General?
No, absolutely not. I'm a coordinator. I'm for the Department of Military Veterans Affairs. I'm the Homeland Security Coordinator.
Okay. And also we have Carol Carroll in the group. And we also have Commissioner Dale Smith. With that, I'd like to go ahead and, Jay, if you'd like to come up and maybe Wayne, and go ahead and give us an overview on your portion of the Homeland Defense proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could also have Mike Conway join us from DEC. He was a part of this also. Mr. Chairman, I thought what we'd do today is I'll give you a short short overview of the group and give you some information on the group's activities from the bioterrorism perspective, and then Wayne can talk about consequence management in other areas, and Mike can talk about DEC. The consequence management subgroup was made up of health and social services, environmental conservation, public safety, law, and military and veterans affairs. The purpose of our group was primarily to examine the state's response capability to chemical, biological, nuclear, radiological, or high explosive events. The subgroup tended to concentrate primarily on chemical and biological attacks for a couple of reasons. First, we hadn't spent disaster cabinet hadn't spent a lot of time previous years looking at those, and secondly, there seemed to be some proven capability out there to deliver those kinds of attacks. The sarin attack in Japan as a chemical event, and also certainly anthrax letters, which were a bioterrorist kind of attack. Within our subgroup, we tended to talk quite a bit about the differences between a bioterrorist attack and others. When we met previously and had the previous overview, we did talk a little bit about how bioterrorism is it different than another kind of attack, and it's different in the sense that you have to spend, in bioterrorism attacks, you have to spend a significant amount of effort on detecting that attack is actually occurring and then identifying the exact nature of that attack. It's not like a hole in the pipeline where you all of a sudden know that someone has attacked a facility. It may be that you don't know that an attack is even occurring until people start to become ill. Once they do become ill, of course, then you have to recognize that. You have to identify exactly what's making them ill, and then you have to decide the course of action to mitigate the problem. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the objectives that came out of our group. These are what we saw we needed to be prepared to do in the sense of consequence management. First of all, we wanted to be able to mount a coordinated response to terrorist attacks from all levels of government. Secondly, we wanted to have sufficiently trained personnel at the state and local level to respond to a terrorist attack. Third, we want to have a reliable communication system to support and response to support the response to a terrorist attack. Fourth, we want to provide state and local first responders with the material and the equipment they need to safely and effectively respond to an attack. And finally, we want to provide state and local responders and emergency planners the opportunity to practice coordinated responses to attacks. Those were the objectives that our group came up with. From that, we started looking then at more specific activities that needed to take place in order to meet those objectives. And there's lots of ways to slice and dice the list of recommendations that we came up with, but the way I chose to do it, in a way that we wanted to look at the things that we thought needed to be done right away. Then we took a look at the holes in our system that needed to be filled in, and then we took a look at what kind of practice we needed to do to make sure the system that we're creating was working correctly. So there were two things that we specifically noted that we needed to do right away. And in the context of this, of course, was in during September and October, when we were actually dealing with anthrax attacks in the lower 48, and we were dealing with anthrax scares here in Alaska. First of all, we recognized that there had to be a need for a quick response to expand the state's capability with regard to hazardous materials. We currently have hazmat teams that are in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and those two hazmat teams were capable of responding to anthrax scares that were occurring in Anchorage and Fairbanks. We didn't have any way of responding to scares statewide, and so we recognized an immediate need that we wanted to fill. And the way we recommended doing that was completing the outfitting and the training and the certification of the 103rd Hazmat Unit. That is a unit that's part of the National Guard, and we wanted to make them capable to be deployed statewide. Secondly, we recognize the need for a kind of immediate and sustainable communication system among healthcare providers. Again, in a case of a bioterrorist attack, we talked last time about the need to have providers be able to communicate with each other, among providers, between providers, and get out information about the nature of the disease outbreak that's occurring and what the plans are to mitigate it. We recommended then that the completion of the Alaska Health Alert Communications Network, which would address this communication need between and among providers. This system is currently about 60% complete, and we recognize the need to finish that system off as soon as we could. The subcommittee also, we talked about this some last time also, the subcommittee certainly also recognized the need to phase in the implementation of the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System as a way of establishing another kind of statewide emergency communication system. The second thing we looked at was we recognized that in order to respond to a bioterrorist attack, that we had some holes in the system, in our current system, that needed to be filled. We recognized the need for additional public health nursing, laboratory, and epidemiological support to identify and characterize disease, develop a plan to attack the disease, and, of course, then to implement that plan. We also recognize the need to go in and actually track for tracking and surveillance to monitor the outbreak to determine if our mitigation plans are actually working. So we needed some kind of an evaluation and a surveillance capability there. As we talked before, these are basic public health functions. There's nothing new here in terms of a new kind of function. It's a matter of degree and a matter of the level of response we're able to mount. The committee also recognized in the long run the need to respond to hazmat situations, and the deployability of the 103rd may not be the way to do that in the long term. The subcommittee recommended establishing additional hazmat teams in four places around the state in the long term. Those would be Kenai, Juneau, Valdez, and Kodiak as areas that should have some level of hazmat response themselves. Finally, as we were going through our anthrax scares, one of the major components of handling that was trooper capability at the local level, because troopers became the agents of working with local government and local police in many of those scares. We recognized the need to for additional law enforcement capacity through the hiring of additional state troopers. The third area we recognized, Mr. Chairman, was that we needed to, once these systems came online and as these systems were coming online and developing their own capability, they needed to be tested. And we recognized the need for two kinds of training. First, on an individual level, we found that there were local police, local fire, to some degree troopers and others who did not have individual training in bioterrorism. And we certainly don't want our local responders being put in harm's way because of a lack of training. So we recognized the need to do more training on an individual basis. We also recognized the need to test the systems once they're developed. And the way to do that is through comprehensive desktop exercises that employ all levels of our response capability so we can see how we work together. And over time, we recognize the need to set up those exercises, execute them, and, of course, learn from what we do wrong in those exercises. So in summary, Mr. Chairman, those are the committee recommendations, they were particularly related to bioterrorism. There were other recommendations related to DEC and also to the normal consequence management that Wayne can talk about.
Representative, before we go any farther, I'd like to go ahead and say for the record that Representative Murkowski, Representative Cott, Representative Cisna, and Representative Hayes are here, and I do thank you for coming. With that, Representative Green.
Do you want questions now or at the end?
Yeah, it might be easier to question him now versus we'll have Department of Transportation up here in a little bit. So if they relate to their field, then feel free to question him.
Thank you, Your Eminence. This sounds like your recommendations certainly are increasing person power. Is that going to be person power that will be utilized in some other arena until there is a need, that they would be first response allowed to leave whatever they're doing? I'm concerned that we get these people and we certainly want them doing something. We don't want them just sitting around waiting. If they're doing something, it's probably important. Will that be so critical that they are then in problem of being able to respond when we...
Through the Chair, Representative Green, yes, the same people the increased workforce related to bioterrorism is exactly the same kind of individuals that we would use to deal with sexually transmitted diseases, TB, other kinds of infectious diseases that the Division of Public Health is dealing with all the time. So these people would not be sitting around waiting for a bioterrorist event. They would be out doing other kinds of public health activities all the time, and then we would have the capability when an attack came that we could pull them off those functions and deal with the bioterrorist event. But there's no idle capacity here. These are all services that we need now under our normal public health services.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Also, I was going to ask, whenever you... When you were investigating the hazmat teams and locations, was any thought given to the local people that may be trained in hazmat in the local areas, such as Kenai? I know that we have a pretty good selection of people that are trained in the oil field for hazmat.
Through the chair, we did look at that, and I think I might have Mike answer that if he could, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Conway. I'm the director of DEC's Division of Spill Prevention and Response. And the hazmat teams that Commissioner Livey had talked about are indeed local citizens. They're not state employees. What we will do is the budget would provide the equipment, the training, the capability for hazmat teams. Currently, we, as the Commissioner said, we have hazmat teams in Anchorage and Fairbanks. The reason primarily that we have them there is that those are the fire departments of those two areas, and they're large enough. They can meet all the requirements of a bona fide level A hazmat team. Other areas of the state, they don't seem to have enough firefighters, emergency responders that they can keep trained within their own budgets and within their own needs. So this, the strategy is to to give them the equipment, the resources that they need so they could maintain a 26-person team. Currently, though, and I'll get into a little bit of my presentation since it's pertinent, is that there's a statewide hazmat team made up of statewide responders all over the state. And DEC leads that team along with the fire departments and police and troopers and all of that. And they meet to look at our capabilities throughout the state. We have response agreements. The state has response agreements with Fairbanks and Anchorage to respond to any hazardous materials incident around the state. And primarily the chemicals that we have to deal with that we're potentially exposed to is ammonia and chlorine. So that's what those groups are designed and equipped and trained to do. And if they're needed in King Salmon, for instance, the state can contract with them to get them to King Salmon. And we have a vulnerability in Southeast. There's no team here. And as you know, the weather can be difficult to get to certain places. So we strategically need to have a team in Southeast, with or without the bioterrorism components there. That's just increased the reasoning or the justification for it. Kenai, we have many chemicals that are in place there, and it just would be able to respond quicker rather than have to come from Anchorage and, you know, that sort of situation. So we're not talking about state employees being the responders. We're talking about empowering and enabling the local communities in those key areas to be able to respond.
And so you're looking at facilities like Agrium with the hazmat training that they provide their people, for instance, on ammonia and other chemicals. That you would be looking at a coordinated group between maybe the refineries and the chemical facilities and possibly the fire departments or even the police department in trying to put together a team where you wouldn't actually be hiring all new state employees to man this hazmat team. You would be looking at going into the community. You may end up supplementing some of the programs that these people are in. Especially, I would say, fire department or police department, but you're not looking at 26 new state employees for that area and then trying to put them out into different sectors of the government.
Correct, Mr. Chair. In fact, the lead would be done by the local fire chiefs and firefighters. They run it. They're going to put the teams together, make sure that they're trained. So it's a we just have the funding in our budget to enable them to be able to do that locally.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you made a very good point that if it's some sort of a bioterrorism attack, water supply or something like that, it might be a while, or some infectious disease, it might be a while in determining that you have a problem, and then you got to try and figure out what the problem is. Why are these people sick or dying? If you're having medically trained people, are you going to be able to pull them off to do something like this? Because as I understand, most of our medical facilities are understaffed now. And then if we were to pull out, I don't know how many people we'd need to pull out to respond to a contaminated water or some sort of an infectious disease that went on, are we causing these people to do double duty now?
Through the chair, Representative Green, you know, if you think about, when you start thinking about possible scenarios, one of the ways that a bioterrorism event could unfold is that in Alaska we have the state of Alaska is the agency that receives reports of reportable diseases. In other words, around the state, providers are required to report to us about what looks like an infectious disease that is weird. And so what would happen is you might start getting your report from Fairbanks, and you might get one from the Kenai, you might get one from Bethel, of some kind of an illness or a sickness that doctors aren't able to identify or they think is the flu, because a lot of the symptoms that relate to these kinds of bioterrorism events are going to look like the flu initially, until people start getting sicker and sicker and eventually die. And so what you would have is these reports coming in, and they would come in to our State Department of Epidemiology. Epidemiologists then would have to be able to be scanning the horizon and make sense out of these reports coming in. And they would eventually recognize that this wasn't just a normal flu outbreak. As the number of cases increased and as the severity of the cases increased, then they would start to look at this as recognizing something else. At that point, they would be in contact back and forth with providers that are out in the field. Are you seeing more of these cases? Tell me more about it. Is it different than a case you saw last week? Trying to nail down exactly what it is they're looking at. Eventually a pattern would emerge that epidemiologists would be able to look at, and then in consultation with the private physician, they would go back out to them with a mitigation strategy and decide how the best way to decide how to attack it is. So in that sense, the state staff people are the ones that are helping to identify the disease, see the patterns, because they're scanning the whole state, not just the few patients they're seeing, and then go out with the mitigation strategy. And the strategy that would go back out to the private physicians would likely be something that they would be wanting to do for those patients anyway. So in that sense, they would just be taking care of their patients, and it would be the state folks who were helping to plan the attack of the strategy.
A response to those that were affected would probably still require medically trained people, as opposed to maybe, and the thing we're going to do to prevent further is what it might be, a build a cofferdam or something, and that could be non-trained people, but it still seems like there would be a taxing on the existing medical.
Through the chair, Representative, there's no question that if there were a bioterrorist attack in Alaska, that our public health effort is very thin now, and it would be strained, as would many of our local physicians and clinics and hospitals. There are not many places in the country these days where there's a lot of excess capacity in the healthcare. Through the 90s, we chose to squeeze a lot of that excess capacity out of our system, out of the healthcare system. And so in a lot of places, it doesn't exist anymore. So we would be pushed. Our systems would no doubt be pushed to take care of folks if there were a mass disease outbreak.
One final. It's all tied together.
One final.
When we have an outbreak, say a fire, and it's beyond our capability, we bring in from outside, does the plan that you have cover that same issue? If we're shorthanded or overworked or something, that we would be a ready dial for bringing in medically trained people and what's necessary?
Through the chair, Representative Green, yes, we do have relationships now with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And in fact, we have CDC personnel who are assigned to our state that are available to help us out. They can help us out in terms of more sophisticated testing than our lab can do. They help us out in terms of being able to ship to us in a hurry any drugs or pharmaceuticals we might need if Alaska stocks are not sufficient, and they can help us with expertise also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Sisma.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It sounds a little bit, I'm assuming that you're using some of the network ideas or strategies or whatever that our existing hospitals have in place, because in Anchorage, the three large hospitals already have a very sophisticated, it sounds like to me, plan, because they've been using it for the last however long, months, weeks, something like that, because they're all at capacity, right? And if they're all at capacity right now, and I've heard them describe how what would happen if some huge catastrophe occurred, they're already ready to jump as those three collective, and I guess the military as well. But and so what you're talking about is growing that out sort of from the center of the intensive, because all CEDC is right there and the state lab is right in the same neighborhood, right?
Thank you, Chair Representative. We do have ongoing planning that we do, with particularly the three Anchorage hospitals. And in fact, there's a meeting coming up, I believe it's next week, to talk about problems particularly in emergency rooms where patients sometimes come to an emergency room and have to be sent to a different hospital because the emergency room capacity is already maxed out. So there are some issues like that, and in the long run, we're going to have to deal with in our system. Excuse me, my understanding of the emergency room problem is not so much that the facilities aren't capable of handling more patients, but there's not available staff that's on call at any one point in time that they can handle the load of patients. So all of those are concerns that we will be working out that we will be planning for over the next short time. And I think the other thing that we want to do is obviously to do the planning, and then also, as I mentioned, we need to test those systems. You know, is a system going to work? Do we have a system that's going to be able to move patients around from emergency room to the right place at the right time? Is there a way to get pharmaceuticals distributed to where they're needed? Does the communication system work between those hospitals correct? All those things need to be tested. And so that's part of this plan, too.
And Mr. Chair, if I may follow up. So does the response to a potential bioterrorism problem also bring some federal funds then that would help us in a bigger sense as well?
Through the chair, the feds have taken a look at this and have made what we hope is, you know, a down payment in terms of appropriating federal money, some of which will come to the states for those kinds of activities. And part of their big package, some of their money is earmarked not for the states, but for the individual providers. And so some of that money could likely go to city health departments for planning, down south county health departments for planning, but also hospitals to help them build a capacity to handle such a bioterrorist event.
Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, and you probably don't want to answer this right now, so I'll get an answer from you later, but in your deliberations, I'm sure you all looked at how prepared we are in each region of the state. And my curiosity question is, where are we strongest as far as preparation and where are we weakest in preparation in the state? And I guess my fundamental question is, even if we do everything that we have in place, will we be 100% prepared? Because, I mean, the state is just so vast, and we have so many resources to protect. So I'm just curious about that, but I can get an answer later. So,
Jim, I think the short answer, Representative, is that after we went through our committee process, I don't think anybody that sat through our deliberations would be willing to sit here and tell you that we are 100% prepared for a disaster attack, or that there wouldn't be damage or there wouldn't be loss of life, because that's 100% guarantee that we're not able to make. What we looked at was trying to develop the current systems we have up to the level where we could mount a response if there were an attack, without frankly spending a lot of new money to develop a whole superstructure of response that may or may not ever be used. That didn't seem prudent given the financial place the state is in, but we thought we could use our existing systems, bolster those, and be able to have a level of response that was meaningful without spending money on new systems entirely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner, thank you. Wayne, I guess if you'd like to lead into your segment, then we'll move right on to you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Rush. I'm with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I'm the coordinator for Homeland Security. In emergency management, we traditionally think of the preparedness phase of emergency management, and that is the phase before a disaster or an event actually happens, we can prepare to respond. And in that preparedness phase, we tend to think in terms of planning, training, exercises, personnel, and equipment. And Commissioner Leiby touched on some of those items, but I'd just like to flesh that out a little bit in terms of plans. The sub-cabinet that we participated in, thought that we needed plans for the larger communities in the state that are specific to terrorist weapons of mass destruction events. And right now we don't have those. In addition, we need an annex to the state emergency operations plan, dealing again specifically with terrorist events, a plan for distribution of the national pharmaceutical stockpile, as well as a plan for detecting and responding to a bioterrorism event. And right now, again, we don't have those. Once then you have these plans in place, you need to identify the equipment and personnel that you need to implement the plan. And many of the items in the governor's Homeland Security package pertain just to personnel and equipment. Then you need to have training, train to the plan, and that doesn't just necessarily mean training new personnel. It means training the people that you have at all levels of government, local, state, and even federal government people here in the state of Alaska, as well as people in the private sector and our volunteer agencies, which are a big part of this emergency management community. And then, to check on the training, you need a series of exercises. And there's a whole progression of exercises that we traditionally go through. But we think that for this terrorism, to prepare to respond to terrorist weapons of mass destruction events, we need a four-year exercise program to get all levels of the emergency management community in the state prepared for one of these events. Now, to tie this all together, and this was a recommendation of the Disaster Policy Cabinet itself, we think we need an Office of Homeland Security to manage this terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, preparation business. Because really it is, if you get right down to it, a business. And one, this would mirror the National Office of Homeland Security. But here's what we think that this office can do for us. Assist in intelligence analysis and dissemination. Maintain an Alaska-specific threat assessment. Develop protocols to respond to weapons of mass destruction events. Work with the National Office of Homeland Security. But beyond that, work with all of the other federal agencies that are involved in this business of Homeland Security. FEMA, Department of Defense, Department of Justice, U.S. Coast Guard, FAA, Center for Disease Control, the FBI, in Alaska, the Alaska Command. In Alaska, the private sector, the utilities, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the communities, and the other states that neighbor, that border us. Provide the governor expert homeland security advice. Coordinate weapons of mass destruction planning, training, and exercises. Develop program budgets and manage weapons of mass destruction grants. And we do get and are in the process of getting federal grants. And the managing of these grants is increasingly more intense and work intensive. Provide a single Homeland Security communications conduit. Develop and review legislative actions and proposals. Establish threat level criteria and procedures. And with utilities and other infrastructure in Alaska, assist them in doing security assessments and make recommendations on how to improve their security. These are some of the functions that we see that this office could provide for the state.
Okay, and I'm not quite sure who I'm directing the question to. Perhaps it may end up being more of a statement. But how much are we reinventing the wheel here? I mean, all 50 states
are in the same situation. We've got the National Homeland Defense Office that has been set up with Governor Ridge, kind of coordinating all this. And one would think that other than Alaska's a unique geographic situation, which does put us in different categories for different things. And for instance, how do you get the vaccination out to remote communities and with difficult weather? Things like that we need to wrestle with on our own. But so much of this, it would appear you could have uniform application, and we wouldn't necessarily have to create a bureaucracy to monitor the federal money that's coming in to make sure that we're doing what all the other 49 states are doing. And I want to understand what kind of coordination is going on with the other states with regards to these same concerns, because I'm certain that every state legislature is looking at what's happening in terms of the security of their citizens. So, and I don't know who I'm directing it to. Wayne, maybe it's you.
Chair, I have a response to that too, and Wayne probably wants to say something also. Representative, I think you're absolutely right. I'm sure that every state is struggling with this issue, and let me just, I guess the best way I can answer that is just my own personal experience throughout the fall as we were dealing with anthrax and other kinds of threats, and thank God we didn't have an actual event, but we had a number of significant issues and episodes that certainly caught our attention. And, you know, as a commissioner of Health and Social Services, I was certainly involved in dealing with those issues, as was my staff. And we were also involved in dealing with troopers, with local law enforcement, at times with Municipality of Anchorage and their health department, with DEC, with a variety of state, with the FBI, with CDC, a variety of state and federal offices that all had a piece of the action. The Postal Service was involved. And if we had not had an organized, centralized structure for contact, communication, organization, helping us ask the right questions, helping us get answers to questions, we would have not been nearly as responsive and nearly as efficient as we were in dealing with the anthrax scares that occurred. When I talked to my counterparts down in the lower 48 that had actual anthrax events, you know, between all those agencies being involved in the solution, frankly, in a lot of places, there was just pure chaos because nobody knew what the other hand was doing. And I think that from an organizational perspective and being able to respond to an event and being able to plan for an event is having that centralized focus where I have a staff person who's assigned to report to Wayne. And if my staff person has a question about how are the troopers going to respond, what are the protocol for cleaning up an event, what's the protocol for getting the municipality of Anchorage involved in this issue, in an event. I have a staff person who can go to Wayne and say, look, Wayne, we've got a serious problem here. We need to work this out. And then we have an organization and a group of people that can sit down at the table, figure out what the questions are, ask the right questions, get an answer back, and we move on. But for me, it's an organizational issue that certainly makes my life easier and I think helps us to get to the point where we have a better response sooner than later.
Can you come in on the coordination with other states?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Murkowski. We do coordinate with other states, and some of the information we get comes from other states. Some of the ideas for how we should proceed in this business of Homeland Security comes from other states. Our state director, for example, is a member of what's called the National Emergency Management Association, National Association of State Directors, and they share best practices, for example. And certainly there's a lot to be learned. I brought with me today a report from the state of Kansas that outlines a study that they had done with regard to possible legislative changes that needed to be made in their state. Just as an example, that we do share information with the states, and a lot of the states are looking at very similar problems. Some of the states are looking at implementing an Office of Homeland Security, much as we are, to help the state coordinate all of these various efforts that have to take place to prepare the state for one of these terrorist WMD events. So we're not the only one that's looking at this. And we have to be very, although there are general practices that certainly we can implement in the state based on what other states have done, we have to make them specific to Alaska. And one of the differences about this terrorist WMD business is that we do have an organization in the state that has traditionally responded to disasters and by law is responsible to do so, the Division of Emergency Services. But now, because of September 11th, we have this whole other aspect of security. And there is no really state security apparatus. And so this Office of Homeland Security would help manage and coordinate that. Heretofore, it's been pretty much up to individual businesses, individual enterprises to do their own assessments, make their own security arrangements, and so forth. But now there's a greater need to have a coordinated security effort. Valdez Marine Terminal is a good example where you need to, especially during a heightened level of security, where you need to coordinate many elements, private sector, state, federal, DOD, et cetera. Working out the procedures for doing that would be one of the tasks of this kind of office.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share Representative Murkowski's concern. And in December, I was really fortunate to be back and hear your, the governor, and his plea for having coordination offices in all 50 states. My concern, though, is what I heard you say, or what I think I heard you say, was that you would be assisting these other groups that are ready to respond. How do you envision your office? Is it a one-man office? Is it a two? I mean, what I would be concerned about is that this could grow into a large entity, and we have maybe three or four probable areas that at least that I can think of that would be a target. And what I'm concerned about is to have another bureaucracy, as you indicated, to do, I'm not sure what. I heard what you said, but I'm not sure how you plan to do that. Could you just give us a thumbnail about the size you anticipate or how you're going to interact with, say, Alyeska that has a response team and maybe the North Slope Pump 1? I'm thinking of, of Valdez.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Green. To answer your question about the staff of this Homeland Security Office, our proposal was a staff of a total of nine people. Also, we did not envision this office lasting forever. It is a solution that would at least could be reduced or possibly even eliminated, as the situation indicates, in the future. To just to give you an example of some of the kinds of coordination that we think this office could do or should do is in the area of managing these grants. These federal grants come to, for example, Department of Health and Social Services, Department of Transportation, I think, will be getting some grants for security. We hope they are. Our department is getting grants from Department of Justice. And as you know, these grants come down to these various departments. We think that we have to have some coordination in order to use this money most effectively to apply it to this problem so that there's no duplication, but also so that we don't leave any holes. That's one example. The security aspect is something that we really haven't had a lot of experience on at state level, and applying security resources, deploying them, doing security assessments, and so forth. And so we think that this office can coordinate that aspect, assist communities, other entities in doing assessments, and make recommendations on how they can improve their security. Hopefully it's at low cost.
I'm a little. Are you finished, or are you going to?
Chairman, can I make clarification? And Wayne can kick me under the table if I'm wrong. But my understanding is, I think when he said nine new people, some of those people are not new employees to the state. Some of those are individuals that are already working in our departments that we now are going to assign to be a liaison to the office. So I think within the nine that he's counting an individual, for example, from health and state employees is considerably fewer than nine.
I'd like to follow up. I'm still, you're going to need what kind of people? Are these going to have to be highly specialized type people, somebody that is really highly specialized in bioterrorism, somebody that knows medical procedures, another one that knows physical problems? And if you're going to utilize people from other agencies, are they going to be shorthanded? Would you have to backfill for the person that you loan? So it is a new employee. It's just a new employee to you to replace the one you loaned in.
Mr. Chairman, we do not plan to backfill for the position that for the person that we're going to assign to go over there. We do not intend necessarily to backfill that person. And we're looking at someone who's more of a high level generalist sort of person that can deal with our laboratories. They can deal with emergency medical services. They understand how epidemiology works and other and all of our function and all of our public health functions.
Do you have a person that's excess that you can actually allow to go over there?
To the chair, I'm not sure they're excess, but I think what we're saying is that bioterrorism is a sufficient threat and a big enough issue for us that we're willing to make some changes other places in the Division of Public Health in order to send somebody over there.
Representative Murkowski.
Has there been discussion of putting this Office of Homeland Security within the Division of Emergency Services? It seems to me that that's kind of the natural point where if there's ever been a situation in the state, the Division of Emergency Services is the one that steps up. So if you had kind of a sub-office or another division within the Division of Emergency Services, it seems to be it would be a good marriage of those individuals that are already qualified and skilled in certain areas, certainly have access to that network. Perhaps it's not as beefed up in the security area as we would like to see, but you could certainly do that beefing up, and it seems to me it would be a natural place to start, and I'm just wondering if that was ever part of the discussion, or did you just look first to creation of a new office?
Chair, to Representative Murkowski, yes, we did consider where we might put this Office of Homeland Security, all the way from working directly for the governor, for the Office of the Governor, to having it in the Division of Emergency Services, having it some sort of separate entity working somewhere else. The recommendation that we made, however, is that it not be part of the Division of Emergency Services, but that it be part of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And so it would be in the same department as the division, as is the National Guard, and work for the same boss, but not be buried in the Division of Emergency Services, would have the visibility and recognition as being a separate entity within the department. And we thought that it would be most effective at that level.
I don't know, it still seems to me that if you put it in emergency services, you've just got that natural network already set up. And not to say that you couldn't access it if you were within the same department.
It would also, our recommendation that it would be located at the National Guard Armory at Fort Richardson. So you have, under the same boss, Division of Emergency Services, National Guard, and the Office of Homeland Security.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Mike, I'll be brief if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what they've said, but we have emergency response systems in place for oil and hazardous substances, and the commissioners talked about existing systems that they have in the health care. We have that as well, and Representative Green over the years is very familiar with that, working on a lot of our issues. And we probably have one of the best in the nation, but it's geared for the peacetime threats and potential accidents and so forth. So when you're looking at the increased activity, and for the 3 months following 911, gave us a glimpse of what, if in the event of attack, what it could be. We respond to all kinds of other emergencies as well. It could be the floods could wipe out the drinking water systems in some of the communities or their home heating tanks and that sort of thing. So there's, in addition to the typical, you know, the big spills that you hear about, there are just sort of the seasonal disasters that we may get involved with. But our capability to address weapons of mass destruction attacks requires a step up in knowledge, equipment, training, and that sort of thing. Give you an idea, we do have hazardous materials response teams around the state. As we mentioned, we have the two fire departments in Fairbanks and Anchorage. There's a certain amount of staffing that DEC works with, sort of helping coordinate, you know, statewide across the municipal boundaries and that sort of thing. But they're geared for the specific chemicals, and I mentioned ammonia and chlorine. We don't know what kind of chemicals that we may face in the event of a terrorist attack. There can be other chemicals, and with that, you need risk assessments to know that. You need specialized equipment. Just because you see somebody in a, you know, some of the moon suits, they call them, with the anthrax attacks back east, you know, going, clearing out the buildings and so forth, doesn't mean that other chemicals or biological agents would be, those suits would be impermeable to that. So there's a certain amount of increased work and attention that goes to that. So we've asked for, we didn't ask for 100 people to respond in the hazmat teams of the 426, but we are asking within our budget for a small cadre of 6 people that will help us statewide get together as far as hazmat, helping all the municipalities, help doing the training, identifying the equipment, getting the equipment. Plus, in the event of an attack, and in the starting on 911 and for about a 2-week period, DEC had people on staff 24 hours a day in the SECC, the State Emergency Coordination Center. And in these kinds of attacks, our agency has a fairly critical role to play that people can't do from their homes, or so we have to have a capability there to be able to do that. We've also asked for some funds to be able to do a source water assessment, risk assessment. Anchorage, the Aklutna Lake, which was talked about by Commissioner Porchot the other day, is the major primary drinking water source for Anchorage. It has a lot of possible routes in there. There's talk all over the country on what would the surface water supplies do in the event of contamination. We don't know what that is yet, but we need to do an analysis. We need to look at the different chemicals that people are considering through intelligence sources of contaminating water supplies and that sort of thing. So we've asked for some money to be able to do that with the surface water sources. And then the seafood lab has been talked about in other hearings. The seafood lab, seafood and food safety lab, is already on the table under bonding for House Bill 51. It is not part of the funding requested with the governor's package. So that's separate, but it drives home the need to have the capability to test the food and the water, because those are the other two. Once, you know, we've had the biological aspects, the other two that are lurking in the background are contamination of food, and we've had that from local terrorists in the Dalles, Oregon a few years ago. There was salad bar was contaminated by a group of people that wanted to affect a local election. And they had 750 people become sick through the contamination of these salad bars and restaurants around the area. So, I mean, that can go on. It doesn't need to be the global kinds of terrorism, but we still have to have the capability that if food's contaminated. Plus, when you look at where we get our food, other than seafood, coming from other places, there's just one point after another, there's the opportunity to contaminate it. And in the seafood lab itself, there's plenty of peacetime uses that we, ongoing over a period of time, and the current lab we've had is just wholly inadequate. But that's, it would, this is one of the things where we take a wheel, the existing wheel, it's not a new wheel, we already have a lab, it's just inadequate. We take the wheel, but we're looking in our toolbox that we're carrying along with the wheel, and there's some tools missing. So we need to be able to look at that a little bit. And that's pretty much it. You brought up earlier the other points I wanted to make about the hazmat teams. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my earlier question about the provider network that already exists, actually, I really meant initially and didn't get there, to widen that umbrella, because really in, certainly in Anchorage, I don't know about Fairbanks or other communities, but in Anchorage there has been an effort to do training right down into the neighborhoods, and the fire department, as a matter of fact, is the one that coordinates that, and I've with my community council and a number of community councils right in that area around the hospital, the hospitals, Merrill Field, all have had community emergency response training, have learned the rudimentaries of triaging, have and are all ready for refresher courses anytime they're made available, and there is an effort to continue that. If that was tied in to some of the other efforts, that's another part of the workforce, and this is kind of one of those opportunities where the more tied in we are with the entire totality of the citizenry that are ready to be mobilized, and I think there's a lot more than you ever think there are. It's the things we were identifying in our training, airplane crashes, earthquakes, there's any number of things, because we're in Alaska, because we are so separated, and because of logistically where we are, we potentially could be a target somewhere down the line. It just makes all kinds of sense to be really well coordinated.
Representative Sisson, through the chair, exactly, and that... I'll give you a real quick overview of the response system in the state of Alaska. We have the State Emergency Response Commission. All the agencies sit on there, as well as local people, firefighters, representatives of what they call local emergency planning committees. And the local emergency planning committees, particularly in Anchorage and Fairbanks, are very well structured, and they get down into the neighborhood. So we meet quarterly anyway, just on all the other threats. We're always looking at threats to earthquakes, fires, all those things. And so I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that is, particularly in Alaska, if there's an emergency, everybody needs to come, and we need to be prepared for it. So this would be building upon that, keeping as many people trained, because there are certain things, if people are going to be responders or if they're even going to come in and volunteer in the State Emergency Coordination Center, there's a certain amount of training. So that's exactly what needs to happen, and the State Emergency Response Commission, which is meeting on the 31st of January here in Juneau, might be an opportunity to see how that plays in, but we've been talking, we've had a couple meetings since 911, and that's exactly what we're trying to do, is keep the existing structure that brings in any citizen who is capable, willing, wants to participate in any kind of emergency response. There is that structure there that gives them that ability, and I'm glad to hear to see how you know, from your perspective and your local community association, it's getting down there. So, yes, ma'am.
Good.
Thank you. Once again, gentlemen, I'm sure that as time goes on and we go through the process, we'll be in further contact with you. With that, I'd like to go ahead and bring up Deputy Commissioner Boyd Brownsfield. And also, if Gary would like to join him.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bo Brownfield. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. With me is Gary Hayden, who's the Director of Maintenance Operation and Construction for the Southeast Region. He's also my right hand in this particular effort. Another with similar credentials is Frank Richards, whom you'll hear about later. He could not be here today. He's in Japan, of all places. Before we launch into the details of our transportation subcommittee, I feel a need to provide a little background to bring this legislative committee to where DOT is now and where we came from since the fateful day of September the 11th of last year, or as we refer to it as 9/11. To say the least, there is a world of very volatile, fast-moving, ever-changing history that we've been through and are still going through. The details I could not accurately recount right now. The highlights I believe you need to appreciate to better understand the direction of our transportation subcommittee activities. Most specifically, it lends meaning to our transportation subcommittee makeup and activities as part of our governor's homeland budget request. Throughout this discussion, there are several important fundamentals within aviation which have not changed from the beginning or since 9/11, nor will they likely change throughout this process regarding our transportation mission. First, the basic FAA process, or Federal Aviation Administration process, the regulations, the funding program in terms of general federal financial aid have not changed. We still have an airport improvement program, what we call the AIP program. The projects to be funded in this year's program and next year are still intact. So far, there has been no major move to substantially change the direction of federal funding from our basic program, at least in the near years, second and third year. And I think that's important. In the heat of battle, we still have our basic program, and some balance and stability still remains. FAA still has the same concerns. They have always been concerned with airport safety. They've always been concerned with airport security, with our maintenance and operation of the airports and our airport management and the proficiency of all of our people within the airport, running the airport, and other parameters that have always been stressed by FAA. But then that's probably where the stability stops. What has changed is the relative importance of one parameter to another within our program. There's a significant and dramatic shuffle of priorities within that program. Most obvious, of course, is the relative importance today of security, which has clearly and rapidly moved to the surface and to the top of the heap in our priorities when we talk about aviation and also highways and marine highways, which I'll touch on later. Early on, in the flurry of panicked response for 9/11 terrorist attack, and even today, FAA quickly put into place a multitude of unfunded mandates to all states demanding rapid response without regard to specific funding mechanisms or paybacks. And under the circumstances, as did all states, we in DOT responded immediately to the new and ever-changing requirements using and accounting for our own state resources to accomplish their work. Over the past 4 months, DOT has responded to directions. We've responded
responded to redirections. We've had almost daily changes. We've had many reversals in earlier decisions. It's been a wild roller coaster experience, to say the least, and it continues. Not as fast as it was at the beginning, but it still continues. The good news, I believe, is that the redirected emphasis is beginning to take shape in the world of aviation. And incidentally, that's an especially important distinction in Alaska, because not only are we the owner and operator of more airports than any other state in the union, that numbers about 262 airports, two international airports, and about 17 security class 3 airports. But we have a huge stake in aviation, since there are Alaskans whose only highway connecting them to the rest of the world is their airport. Things are, however, as I said before, starting to fall in place. From the early stages of closing American skies to all aircraft, to the FAA's initial and extremely narrow use of our National Guard assets at our airports, with which, if logic were to prevail at the time, could have been available to offset otherwise undoable demands placed upon our limited airport resources, to a significantly increased demands for continuous on-airport law enforcement resources, or what we call LEO, law enforcement officer resources and security forces, that we were neither able nor funded, and a host of other FAA mandates coming like a rapid machine gun fire, making our life challenging at best in DOT and to the entire Homeland Security team as it developed. Through the hard work, pushing FAA, challenging their decisions, applying logic and reasoning, and then sometimes fighting the bureaucratic and somewhat stubborn biases that FAA can have at times, we in Alaska have been very successful in many areas at easing our burden. For instance, Alaska was the first in the nation to restore aviation use in our skies. If you recall, FAA closed all air traffic on September 11th in the nation. Our skies were open 2 days later. It was weeks, and for general aviation, sometimes months, for full free flight to be restored in the lower 48. Ours was done in two days. That wasn't because it just happened. We had to fight hard for that. We, along with the help of our Alaska FAA representatives, were granted a more liberal use of the National Guard troops at our airports, a far more liberal use of them than what was originally intended. That freed up our permanent resources and allowed our airports to maximize the use of their people where they were needed the most. We entered into a temporary agreement with local police forces to provide the early heightened security mandates imposed by FAA for full LEO, law enforcement officer support, at our airports. Unfortunately, this particular issue, we had to do that at our own expense, because there was nothing else to do. That expense we didn't have to spare. Nonetheless, the job had to be done, so we did it. Most recently, we in Alaska have been granted a waiver from the 300-foot setback, sort of a no-man's land established in front of the airports, to any and all traffic and parking. This was granted to our rural airports, not to our international airports. Most of us, most of you all now, are experiencing, if you haven't in the past, the turmoil of that requirement in our own Juneau International Airport. Without a waiver like this, this issue alone would have probably cost us upwards of about $15 million to establish that setback within the state of Alaska with so many airports that we have. We've been able, through hard negotiation with FAA in Washington, D.C., to make that waiver. Also, just recently, we've been granted a waiver from the requiring all of our LEOs to be physically at the airports one half an hour before and after a scheduled aircraft arrival and departure. Another requirement, which would have significant monetary impacts on us in Alaska, about $8 million. We hopefully don't have to shell out. And it's now being restored. That particular LEO service is being restored back the way we had it before 9/11. I got to acknowledge at this time the unwavering support and alliance that we had of the Alaska FAA administrator, Mr. Pat Poe and his security chief, Mr. George Paul, whom we work with very, very closely, to the extent of their authority, and maybe in some cases a little bit more than authority. They fought very hard in Washington, D.C. for Alaska interests, and we certainly appreciate that. Some more good news, much of our efforts and future requirements may be eligible for federal funding. In fact, they are. Some may be above and beyond the normal AIP program that we have now. Unfortunately, some of the things that FAA is going to bring down to us will be dipping into the share that we have of the FAA funding, which would otherwise go to other things. That's that priority of security now rising to the top, along with safety, because nobody would ever suggest that we're going to lower safety. We now have two priority ones, not a one and a two. We will certainly see a reshuffling of priorities and toward the security measures by FAA, and we'll continue our new journey, and by no means are we finished. In fact, an important reality for all of us to recognize and to understand is that the heightened, the more secure, stringent requirements that we've experienced today above the business as usual that prevailed before 9/11 will be our business as usual tomorrow. We will never go back. Our challenges will be greater, and our changes are going to be permanent. So far, I've talked about our struggles and accomplishments with aviation. Of equal importance to us is what we have in the safety and security of our highways and our bridges and our marine highway transportation systems, specifically marine highway. We talk of a terrorist attack, they look for big splashes. Certainly, Alaska is not in the center of mass in the United States, but any big splash, like an airplane anywhere around the globe, falling out of the sky with 260 people in it, is a big splash. At any one time, you can put a terrorist in a situation where it's in our marine highways, and we can make a splash that accounts for maybe 600 or more people. So we have that threat, and that's something that we have to address. I won't go into specific detail this evening with you in the surface and the marine highways, simply because, to a large extent, those issues parrot the issues of aviation. Suffice it to say that we're looking very hard in the vulnerability of our highways and our bridges, primarily the bridges, because how do you make safe 5,000 center miles of road all at one time? And, of course, our marine highways, which is a very big concern to us today. Some good news is that we feel also in the FHWA route, in the federal highways route, we can get some federal funding pointed in that direction in some instances. I don't think it'll be as available as it, hopefully it'll be in the FAA or the aviation arena, but it will be available. In the interim, we're doing what we can now to minimize that vulnerability. We need to do more, and that again is reflected in our transportation portion of the governor's budget request on Homeland Security. One last thought before I let Gary brief you a little bit on our Homeland Security Transportation Subcommittee is that with very little, if any, exception, our new expanded mission in aviation is driven by a federal mandate. We don't have much choice. It's a federal mandate. Hopefully that we can maximize funding that they can bring to the table, but they're not going to pay it all, nor can we expect for to pay it all, because the situation we're in today is shared by all of us, all Americans. So we're going to have to pay our share. Unfortunately, this is not so much the case as we get to our surface and marine highway security measures, because I said before, we're probably going to have to look at it very hard ourselves, and probably do more for ourselves, looking as much as we can to FHWA, but understanding we probably don't have the resources there yet that can be brought to bear in aviation. And I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. With that, I'd like Gary to give you a little bit of our Homeland Transportation Subcommittee makeup, what our mission is, where we're headed, since he has been basically in a leadership role the entire time in that particular endeavor.
I'd like to ask him to brief you on some of the details. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do three things. One, give you an overview of the organization report, tell you what approach we took, and then highlight about six common themes that are across all the transportation modes. The first thing we did was get organized. We broke our task up into three subcommittees: surface, aviation, and marine. And in the scope that we were looking at in each one of those, in surface, we looked at highways, bridges, transit systems, the bus systems around the state, and the Alaska Railroad. Aviation included Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the 17 rural airports. In the introduction, I think you'll see pretty much that what we can do with the other 262 are fairly limited and was outside the scope of the short time period that we had. Then a marine subgroup looked at the marine highway system. In conjunction with the Coast Guard, they talked to, they looked at ports and harbors around the state and also the issue of cruise ship security. Then after we got the groups organized, the process sort of analysis that we did was a five-step process. First, we looked at what are the priority assets that needed to be protected or to be prepared to respond to. Then we looked at what current security measures had. I think with the exception of aviation, you'll see that there wasn't a whole lot of security measures in place for the other assets that we identify in the report. Then we looked at the vulnerability of these assets. Then we, after looking at the vulnerabilities, we established priorities. And then from the priorities, then we made recommendations as to how to protect or to respond to those priorities, and ones that were the most vulnerable and the highest value. And then we broke the recommendations down into short-term and long-term. And some of the short-term we have initiated and we've got currently underway. In the long-term, still a matter of discussion and redirection. But out of that process, I characterize, and from my sort of personal look at everybody's work, was that there are about six themes that are common to all of those. And I've also heard those same themes in some of the presentations that you've already heard for the last 3 days. One, there's prevention. The report identifies some of the recommendations or security actions that we can take in the short term, long term, that may deter the use of our transportation system as a target. Two is mitigation. We can take some actions now to reduce the harm that would make our transportation system an attractive target, and also that would allow us to have a better response in the recovery mode. Then there's preparedness and contingency planning. We identified several recommendations that would assure that we have a rapid recovery in the event that we had an attack, and a return back to service as soon as possible. A very common theme, not only within all of our three groups, but I've heard almost everyone talk about, is communication, and we had a real good discussion about the land mobile radio system. One thing that DOT is one of those response organizations that gets out and sort of does the cleanup or the recovery mode in natural disasters, and we've definitely, the experience on the avalanche showed the real need for better communication system between us, military, and the police. I think we've spoken about that enough. The next common theme that was driven home was the need to emphasize security. DOT excluding the aviation security program, and we currently have about 150 security people at the two international airports, security was not in our mission statement. It wasn't one of the things that we routinely sat around and thought about. We don't have any expertise in security. Since that 9/11, that's changing, and we're going to have to get up to speed and to start learning about security. And there's some recommendations on how to do that in the report. And then the last thing is training. My experience in observing security issues is it takes some expertise in security. And DOT, while we may have 3,000 people, security is not something that we're particularly trained to do, excluding the aviation. So there's some recommendations in there about how we can train our staff and do a better job at security. So with those, that's sort of a real general summary. I think each one of you have got the report, and we can talk about any particular recommendations that you'd like to discuss and get into detail of. One thing I'm not prepared to do right at this moment is talk details on the dollars. Those things are changing, and we're even revising. I think last time we met, there were some questions in there. Since then, Bo's already mentioned aviation has lessened up, and we've saved $25 million in the last 5 or 6 days. So the money is still a little dynamic, and I don't have my finger right on the button, but I'd be happy to talk about any of the rest of it.
Thank you, Gary. Representative McCaskey.
Thank you. I noticed in the long-term aviation recommendations, you indicate that it's important to review the terminal configuration at the Anchorage and Fairbanks International Airport. And I would just suggest that since we're in the middle of that remodel now, we do it sooner instead of on the back end.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kowski, we have done that. We've already issued a directive to our contractor through a consulting firm to look at that. So that is underway as we speak.
Any questions?
That would apply also to some of the other transportation planning and the traffic planning in Anchorage, because all of that's undergoing review right now.
Right.
So,
I, you know, prior to 9/11, security was not one of the issues that we normally looked at in the whole planning process, and that's something. We're not there yet, but DOT's got to get security inserted as one of the items that we're looking at when we're planning, when we're designing, and when we're constructing projects.
You also said that the waiver, you've received a waiver for rural airports, but not to internationals?
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, it's the rural, but not the international. The international still has that 300-foot setback, as we said just a second ago. That's something we're looking at, and they're looking at what they're doing now, revising construction plans to make sure that we meet the criteria that has changed since we started construction. But that I don't think that'll, for instance, you and I will always, we're still going to be faced with this issue out here at the Juneau International Airport. I think they're higher than a Class 3 security, and they're going to have to keep that 300-foot setback, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not really sure because they don't belong to us, and since we have 262 of them, I got enough to think about beside them.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, in one of the previous hearings that we had, I made a statement in response to a question that we had asked for our security classification at these 17 airports to be downgraded. This waiver that we received is in lieu of, we're not going to get a reclassification of those airports. Instead, we got a waiver on these two items.
And Mr. Chairman, I might point out, though, that we got what we wanted, and that is the relaxation from the 300-foot setback and the requirement for LEOs. And one of the other things we did over here is we weren't required. One of the few things we did on our own volition is we're not required at Valdez to set up the security that we have at the rest of our airports simply because they don't have the implants. We felt because of its location, because of the sensitivity of it, because a 172 general aviation aircraft can do a whole lot of damage across the bay over there to Prudhoe Bay, the southern terminus, that we had to treat that as what we call a Class 3 security airport. So we have security there. We have all these things in place that we have at our other airports that are Class 3, simply because we did it on our own, knowing it's probably sensitive, if not more sensitive, than some of the other airports that are Class 3.
No other questions? Get out light today. As I stated with the other commissioners, I'm sure that as this proposal goes through the budget process, that you'll be asked more questions. With that, I do appreciate it. I do appreciate everybody that attended. Next week's schedule is Tuesday the 29th, 3 to 5 here in room 124. We'll be looking at HCR 20 and HJR 31. Mike Mitchell, you still online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay?
You bet. Did you have any other comments or anything in particular you wanted to talk about, Mike?
Well, given the hour, I'll just briefly let you know that there's a package of five bills other than the funding bill, which comprise the governor's anti-terror package. I believe that each of those will be scheduled for a hearing. If you'd like, I can give you a brief rundown on each of those, but if you'd like, I can also wait.
Yeah, I have a rundown on all of them. You're speaking of HB 323, 24, 25, 26, and 27?
That's correct.
Yes. We have received those. We're still waiting on backup and hearing requests before we schedule them. And so it may be more appropriate at that time that we talk with you.
Okay.
With that, Mike, I appreciate you staying online. I didn't realize that's probably what you were on there for. I would have let you get your part done earlier, but I do appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll bring the meeting to a close. And meeting is Tuesday the 29th, 3 to 5 here in this room. Thank you for attending. We have